Looking into wine, does wine science, micro-oxygenation, or MOX to his mates, is a controlled, periodically continuous addition of tiny amount of oxygen to wine, usually red. Forget the new world of being leaders in technical winemaking innovation. MOX was devised in 1991 by Patrick de Corneau of Domaine Moreau in Madiran as a way of softening the tannins of his own grape variety, Tannat, which has legendary tannins. Benefits include color stabilization, the building up and softening of the structure of tannins, lessening of stinking reductive notes. It is now widely used across the winemaking globe on tannic grape variety. MOX and Pinot Noir are unlikely ever to be best buddies. With my guest Clark Smith, who has been working, researching and studying the use of micro-oxygenation in wines since 1997, we go through some of the myths about micro-oxygenation and we discussed how most winemakers only use to stabilize color and to speed up the bottling times, but in truth, micro-oxygenation applied to specific stages can help with the structure of the wine tannins, thus producing wine that can age longer and being more approachable when they're young. Hi, I'm Mattias Carpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, process, and concept that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey, Looking Into Wine. Welcome to Looking Into Wine. I'm Mattias Carpazza, and today's guest is the founder of Vinovation, which was providing high-tech services and consulting for over thousands of wineries over the years. And he wrote in 2013 the book Postmodern Winemaking, where he explores the flaws in wine chemistry for the winemaking schools, which he fought for over 15 years. And today he's here to talk about micro-oxygenation, what is it, and what is it used for. Welcome to the podcast, Clark Smith.
Thank you, Mattia. It's so great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you to be here again. We already have a conversation about your book, and it was a great success. And then I was very happy for you to be here again today to talk about micro-oxygenation. So for those who haven't listened to the first episode, Clark wrote this amazing book about winemaking and some of the things that then wine school didn't get right. So I suggest everybody to go and listen to the other interview that we did together. But today we're here to talk about micro-oxygenation.
Well, and this is an example of a technique that's very widely used, but winemakers don't like to talk about it because there are some sort of enemies of winemakers in the natural wine movement that like to put forth the fiction that winemaking, that the best wines are made without any effort. It's just not true. And we have a lot of, they're really cooking techniques. Winemaking is just a very long range form of cooking where you use a calendar instead of a timer. So I want to really, we're talking about a cooking technique here. And I think it's important for winemakers to be more honest and proud about what they do and not be intimidated by the opposing forces.
For me, it's a very interesting topic, and I'm really enjoying exploring it and reading about it. And I hope I can bring some of my listeners to a good conversation, to have a good conversation with winemakers, which I think is very interesting. So, Clark, when did you start working and studying about micro-oxygenation in winemaking?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. There was a guy named Thierry Lemaire, French guy who got a hold of me in 1997, and he said, "I want to buy you a beer." And so we met in the bar of the MGM Grand Hotel in Reno, Nevada. And he said, "I want to talk to you about a technology we've developed in France." And everybody said that you're the guy to talk to, that your Vinovation is a company that people trust, and we deliver innovations to the industry. And that was kind of true. And so I heard him out, and he said, "Well, we have this tool that will that will add longevity and richness to wines and refine the tannins, stabilize color, balance reductive strength, and integrate pyrazines, you know, the bell pepper aromas and oak constituents and microbiological constituents. You know, this is like the any winemaker's dream list of positive outcomes, and all of your daughters will marry doctors. And I'm just, and all you have to do is exactly the opposite of what you were taught in school. So, I thought he was crazy, and so we agreed to do a collaborative study in the industry, and those take about 2 years, and try it out. So we didn't want to be associated with it. We didn't want to claim that it really worked, but we were willing to experiment with it. So we had this big disclaimer on the website, and it was there for 2 years, that just said, well, if you want to work with us to try this out, it looks crazy to us, but we're willing to organize a trial. And then 2 years later, we took it down because everything he said was true.
So it was the machine, the dream machine for a winemaker. And as you were saying, it helped with tannins, with color, and all the things we're going to discuss later. And you were talking that he was a guy from France, because microoxygenation originally came from France. Where was he invented, and what it was, again, why it was invented?
Well, let me, I would say it was rediscovered. If you don't mind, I want to go all the way back to ancient winemaking and talk about enological oxygen. So if you go to the Republic of Georgia, to the Ekalto Monastery in Kakheti region, this was a 4th century monastery that was also a winemaking school. And if you go there, they have a crushing station that's up on top of a mountain. And they have, Lord knows how they did it, they dug this tunnel 2 kilometers through the mountain down to the university. So they were gravity feeding. They would go all the way up there and crush the grapes. And so then the juice would come down through the mountain. And then they'd put the skins and the seeds in a donkey cart and bring them down. And everything was gravity fed into these clay jars in the ground. They call them treveries. Why do they do that? The only possible explanation is that they knew about something that we call hyperoxygenation, which is what I do with my aromatic whites. You know, things like Riesling and Muscat have, they're very delicious. And so the bees and birds attack them. And so they have to make a lot of tannin to sort of cauterize the wounds that come from predators. So just like a banana or an apple, one of these grapes will, the wound will turn brown. So you have all these tannin, and it's a problem because when it oxidizes, a side reaction is hydrogen peroxide, and that attacks the fresh, fruity aromas and turns them into petrol and kind of makes a stale wine. So they must have known this because they're taking Riccazzatelli, which has this same property, and they're oxygenating it before they ferment it, to brown out these tannins so that the wine is more fresh.
Yes, it's a great story there. And I mean, I never heard of it.
Yeah, so now we fast forward to World War II and Hitler and the bomb and the politics that caused us to spend enormous amounts of resources in order to split the atom. And once we had it, we investigated a lot of peacetime, you know, energy production and other peacetime nukes. And part of the discovery, and this was Germans, they figured out that we could slide these plastic sheets into atomic piles, and the alpha particles would etch holes, and they put them in a bath of fluoric acid, and you end up an integrity-testable sterile filter. Now, before that, all those German Rieslings, like the Spätlese, were not sweet, because before World War II, an off-dry white wine was a high explosive. So when we got these integrity testable filters, we were able to bottle these off-dry wines. And the one that changed the world was Blue Nun. So all of a sudden, we could have sweet, fresh wine. And the Germans invented a whole system involving stainless steel and inert gas and basically keeping oxygen away from those light, fresh whites. And that just swept the world. So all the white wine we drink today is children of Blue Nun. All the way to New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. It's not sweet, but it is very fresh. And they work really hard to keep the oxygen away. And so the whole idea that oxygen is the enemy of wine got started in Germany. And then Emile Peynot in Bordeaux, not to be outdone by the Germans, they pulled in the stainless steel and the inert gas, and they started making Cabernet as if it were Riesling, as if oxygen is the enemy of wine. For a long time, the next thing that happened was the flying winemakers came over from Australia because the British supermarkets were saying, you know, the French are making all this terrible wine. Why don't you come over here and show them how to make it? So their solution was to let the grapes hang on the vine. So it's to sort of break the spirit of the antioxidative power of the wine. And it worked really great for making grocery store wines that you were going to drink up the same day. But those wines didn't age at all. And that led to the disaster of the 97 Barolos, for example. So then, in the middle of all this, this peasant winemaker named Patrick Ducourneau was in Madiran, which is kind of halfway between Bordeaux and the Pyrenees. And he just had a little winery there. And their grape is Tannat. Now, Tannat has tons of tannin, like three times as much tannin as Cabernet Sauvignon. And everybody was pulling it out because the wines were terrible. they were harsh and bitter and just like putting cocoa in your mouth. So he had a dream that the problem was that the wine was starved for oxygen. So he went over to Montpellier, and he got with a guy named Michel Moutonnet, who's the top phenolic chemist in France. And Ducourneau suggested that he take a little ceramic reverse osmosis membrane, cut a little piece out of it, and use that to diffuse oxygen into the wine and see what happened. And so at first he was doing just a little bit, about, you know, a barrel normally gives about 1 milliliter of oxygen per liter of wine per month, very slow. And he was using 3 or 4, and it made a huge difference. In all of these areas, in stability and soulfulness and color and core fruit. Well, by the time I got there in 1999, they were using 180 barrel equivalents and making wines that were just huge and lovely and age-worthy. And so that's how it all got started. Patrick and of course, Thierry was one of his lieutenants.
Basically, the principle of microoxygenation is this ceramic disc that is set inside the tank and shoot through a calculated amount of oxygen. How does one go and calculate it, and what are the risks?
Well, we don't have a way to actually until recently. I developed about 5 years ago a way that we can actually measure the wine's oxygen appetite. But before that, it was all sensory. There are several different kinds of tannin, and when you're working with oxygen, it'll transform from a green tannin to a hard tannin, and then round tannin, and then firm, and then you get this velvety impression. And you can stop before you get completely velvety and retain some of the grip. And that will give you a wine that ages for a long time. And paradoxically, microoxygenation done well increases the lifetime of the wine and even forces you to hold it longer before you release it. It's counterintuitive. People think that microoxygenation is for pushing the wine faster to the market, but it's really the opposite.
In your book, you mentioned the people or winemakers do get it wrong, the function of microoxygenation. And especially when you talk in a book, there are three phases to use the microoxygenation during during fermentation, post-fermentation, but before malolactic fermentation and after malolactic?
Well, not during fermentation, we call macrooxygenation, and that's just for yeast health. The yeast are so hungry that the phenolic refinement can't take place in the fermenter. You have to wait till the fermentation is over and even falls clear. And then you come in prior to malolactic, as you say, and the wine is very hungry for oxygen. So a Cabernet will take 60 barrel equivalents. And you'll be moving. The main point there is to stabilize color and to build some body. So this is like a tannin souffle. Where, you know, when you make a souffle, you separate the egg from the yolk because the yolk will quench the reaction. And then you take a wire whisk and you bring air into the whites to make a meringue. And once you have the meringue, now you have a rich light structure. Now you can bring the egg yolks back and fold them in for fat. All right, so that's exactly what we're doing. The wire whisk, instead of a wire whisk, we're using a diffuser, but it's the same idea. We're bringing minute amounts of oxygen in, and we build this rich light structure from the tannins. And then later on, we'll stir the lees, and they act like the egg yolks, to coat the tannin so that it's round and stable.
Okay, and we're talking about structure. The structure you mean is very different to a structure that most consumer or sommelier talks about. You're talking about a molecular level of...
Right, right. When the masters of wine talk about structure, they're talking about, you know, the balance of acid and... You know, alcohol balance and acid balance and sugar balance and all those things. This is these structures exist in the mind of the master of wine. They don't exist in the wine. It's a human structure, a concept. I think balance is a better term. But what I'm actually talking about is the colloids that are in the wine. Let me ask you a question. What's is it true or false that the sensory properties of, and so I'm talking about of a wine, so the appearance, the color, the aroma, the flavor, the texture, are a consequence of the wine's composition?
Well, I would think so. I mean, yes, I would say yes. I think definitely.
Yeah, we usually get two answers. Some people say, well, yes, it's true. And other people go, well, it's so obviously true. Why are you asking such a stupid question? So then I have another question for you. Are the sensory properties of a lump of coal, a graphite tennis racket, and a diamond a consequence of their composition? And by the way, they're all 100% carbon.
Well, I mean, I think they're different in the way that the structure molecularly, the density, or
yeah, that's exactly right. The way the carbons relate to each other, the way they're hooked together, and so, you know, structured foods tend to be more soulful. They have this property we call aromatic integration. So, like a béarnaise sauce, doesn't really smell like the things that are in it. It doesn't really smell like tarragon and onion and vinegar and mint. It just has this kind of integrated kind of Bernese aroma. another example, you go into a restaurant and they have two soups for you. One is a vegetable consomme and the other is a lobster bisque.
Yeah.
Which one are you going to go for? You know, the consomme is just a solution with vegetable flavors dissolved in solution. And it's not very soulful. The bisque is a structure. It's got little particles of gouge in it. So what oxygen really does is, because the color molecules don't polymerize, they're like the bookends on polymerization. If we can stabilize the color very early, then we get short polymers that don't interact so much with our salivary proteins, so the wine is less astringent. And the texture is very, very refined. You know, in French, finesse means It means fineness, but it also means elegance.
And is there any sort of way, grape or any place where a producer would choose not to use macro-oxygenation?
Yes, the lighter the wine is, the Pinot Noir is very tricky. Some Pinot Noirs are dense and dark. The Côte d'Or, good example of wines that respond very well to oxygen. But the Côte de Beaune, not so much. Ethereal wines, they don't have a lot of tannin. They don't have a lot of color. And so they don't protect themselves very well. The other one that surprises people is Zinfandel. Zinfandel is very fragile.
Yes, and I was reading, and can you have the risk of having oxidization or reduction if you don't know? Is that one of the risks of micro-oxygenation if you're not 100% secure what you're doing?
You do increase the reductive strength of the wine when you challenge it with oxygen. It's kind of homeopathic, and we understand the chemistry of why this is true. I'm not going to bore your people with that, but it's scientifically well understood how that works. And this has happened to us. Some of the wineries in the Central Valley that are used to making huge amounts of bulk wine and then selling it very quickly, it doesn't work. We would go in there, they'd have 50,000 gallons of Petit Sirah, and we'd oxygenate it, and we would turn it into a much better wine, but then it would be really reductive, and they'd have to wait an extra year to clear that tank, and so they weren't very happy. Even though the wine was much better, it just didn't fit their program. So you do have reduction problems if what you're trying to do is release the wine early. Then you don't want to do phase one. You wait for phase two, and then you're sort of quenching the wine. You can use oxygen to push a wine for more early release, but it's really not what the tool is for.
Absolutely. I mean, that's it's very interesting because I was reading on different grape variety that they need different level of oxygen, and there's a lot of tables and a lot of specific numbers. But I was also trying to understand how does micro-oxygenation differ racking, which does similar thing. How does one would?
No, it actually does the opposite. We call that violent or punctual oxygen, and that sort of breaks the wine. So you're pushing it along. It's also sometimes called cliquage because there's a French machine that you can drop a diffuser into a barrel and just blast it with oxygen for a few seconds. So there's a radio, you're climbing around the barrel stack, and you have this remote control that turns on the solenoid to give you your blast of oxygen in it. And so the solenoid goes click, but it's a French solenoid, so it goes clique. And and that's where cliquage comes from. Thierry used to tell me that it's sort of like when you're making fine furniture, you put a layer of varnish down, so now you have more structure, and then you come with the steel wool and you sand and polish it and smooth it down, and then you put another layer and then you sand and polish that. That's the difference between micro-ox and cliquage.
Absolutely. Clark, I mean, I got a last question for you, because I was reading that, I mean, micro-oxygenation is very popular, and it's very, much to my surprise, I didn't know how popular it was, but it was I was reading that the famous Michel Roland, who was a famous consultant, he was prescribing to use the micro-oxygenation in Bordeaux for years, and yeah, absolutely.
And you know that terrible film, Mondovino, they're trying to be critical of him. And so, you know, basically he was on his phone saying, well, here, micro-ox this, micro-ox that. And that's really what he does. That's what I do. And I guess they just thought he laughed too much.
And how for you, how widely used it is, in a percentage of, I know you know California well,
Well, I would say every winery in the Central Valley, all the big wineries do phase two. And it's often to soften the tannins from, you know, kind of crappy wood. But the, and you, I mean, you see that all over, but everybody in the Central Valley does it. And, you know, maybe half of the medium-sized wineries in the North Coast. Phase one, I think it's maybe 5 or 10% of winemakers, because it takes training. It's like, you know, everybody can cook, but to have a trained chef is a different thing. Part of the problem, back in the 70s when we didn't know anything, we were all talking to each other. But now there's a lot of feeling about trade secrets and that kind of thing. So there's some resistance to palate training. But I think it's such an effective technique that over time it will find a larger place.
As you say, it is a technique and is a use of something that works a structure. And definitely, as I can see it having less problem than using of herbicides or using other things that can kill environment. That's as a technique and you're using, you're free to use it if you wanted to use it, it's there. You just have to learn how to use it. And I think that's the difference between a lot of...
I mean, it's air.
Yeah, exactly.
what could be less toxic than air?
Absolutely. Clark, again, thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. And Clark Smith is the author of Postmodern Winemaking, and he has a website where he talks about wine chemistries and he gives courses in the USA about wine chemistry. And it's very fascinating. I hope then we will have the time or the opportunity to speak about another winemaking technique or something in the future, maybe for the next season. And
the website is whoisclarksmith.com.
Thank you again for your time today, Clark. I hope you enjoyed this episode with Clark Smith on micro-oxygenation. Remember to hit the subscribe button if you're enjoying this podcast, and if you find it that it gives you valuable information, please give us a review and tell your friends. Also, be sure to go to mattiascarpazza.com and to subscribe to the mailing list. It's the only way you can listen to the pressage, the after-interview conversation with the guest. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can donate on mattiascarpazza.com. You can find Looking Into Wines on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Apple Music. And every listening app. Thanks again to today's guest, Clark Smith. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo. Editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.